Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty at Vanderbilt University. I'm Chris Benda, Librarian for Religious Studies and Theology at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Joel Harrington, Centennial Professor of History and Professor of German Studies, about his recent book, Dangerous Mystic, Meister Eckhart's Path to the God Within. Joel, thanks for being willing to do an interview with me.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
In your acknowledgments, you write, quote, "I came to this project as an interloper from the 16th century, the period of European history most familiar to me," unquote. So my first question is why? Why leave the 16th century, travel back to the late 13th and early 14th centuries to focus on a figure like Meister Eckhart?
Yeah, that's a great question because, as you said, I actually work on the Reformation of the 16th century. To be honest, I was at the point in my career where I wanted a challenge. I wanted to try something different. And Eckhart was somebody that I'd heard about a lot and read somewhat, but I hadn't found a book that really answered a lot of the questions I had. And most of the books I found about Eckhart were either written by philosophers for other philosophers or by theologians for other theologians. And I thought, well, you know, I'd like to try to figure things out about Eckhart and maybe talk to a broader audience. So it was a challenge. It's a lot of my colleagues think it's a crazy thing to do, to go back out of your field, your area of comfort. But I learned a lot, and hopefully that comes across.
Right. So for those who aren't really familiar with Meister Eckhart, and of course this entire book is about him, so you can't kind of retail what you wrote, but basically, who was he? I mean,
well, Eckhart, most people, if they've heard of him at all, they think of him as a mystic, but I think that's somewhat misleading because the common image of a mystic is someone who has visions or who has special powers, and he's not that kind of a person, really. He's a mystic more in the sense that he talks about a way of experiencing the divine directly. So it's an experiential kind of phenomenon. He was a Dominican friar, so he was a member of the Dominican order. He was a priest. He was a professor of theology. He was an administrator. He had a lot of different roles in his life. He was not somebody who was sealed up in a cloister somewhere. He was out in the world working with people. But in the midst of all this, he came up with this way of talking about how people can experience God within, and he decided to take that message to a broader public.
So how do we know about him? I mean, what sources did you use to sort of reconstruct his life?
Right. So he lives from approximately 1260 to 1328, and there are not a lot of good biographical sources, you know, things that in modern historians like letters or diaries or other sorts of things, what we call ego documents, there aren't a lot of those.
Ego documents
okay. Are documents that help you get inside of somebody's way of self-fashioning, how they imagine themselves. And so, like, a diary is an obvious example.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't a lot of these type of documents. The main thing, there are scraps about his historical life and his places that he was, but the main source that I used were his sermons.
Mm-hmm.
And I used his sermons in two ways. One way is to talk about his ideas, obviously, but the other way is to get a sense of Eckhart, because I read about 120 German sermons and then also a couple dozen Latin sermons. And as I said, most people, scholars who read this, have been focusing on the philosophy of theology. And I am somebody, I'm a social historian, and we practice what we call reading against the grain or reading between the lines and taking texts that were intended for one thing and trying to draw information from them about something else. So in this case, I used that and some other miscellaneous sources, the sources from his final trial, his interrogation and trial survive. But it was a challenge because there were not a lot of what we would think of as traditional biographical sources, which is why very few people have attempted to write a biography of them. So that makes sense.
Yeah. So as you, I think you've already alluded to, this book and actually an earlier one, The Faithful Executioner, came out from publishers that are that tend to be more associated with a popular publication rather than academic in the sense of like a university press. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering why you chose to go in that direction for this book, as well as the earlier one, and how this choice affected how you wrote the book.
So the earlier book was about a 16th century executioner, mm-hmm. and I found his journal that he kept for 45 years. And I was telling various friends about this who were not academics, and they were all really interested in this. So I had intended it to be an academic book, but the more I talked to other people, they said, oh, you should aim for a broader audience. And so what I think of a general history book, it should be something that ideally is useful and worthwhile for both academics and non-academics. The problem is sometimes you don't satisfy either one of them and you fall between them. So I think that mostly worked. I was gratified by that. And so I like the idea of writing for a broader public because I think of it as sort of an extension of the vocation of teaching. Mm. You know, what we do in the classroom is we take our expertise and try to put it in terms that are accessible to non-experts. And this is a kind of teaching. I was also inspired by Eckhart, who, as I mentioned, was aimed at a general public. He took very ideas that were usually limited to the academy, and he did something extremely unusual and tried to put them into terms that average people could understand. Mm-hmm. A lot of his contemporaries thought that was a dangerous thing to do, but I thought it was ironic that here's Eckhart, who spent the second half of his career aimed at a general public, and most of the scholarship is written just for experts. And so I thought, you know, I would help Eckhart reach a broader audience in the 21st century.
Right.
So that's, and to be honest, when I'll be, you know, when you write and spend a lot of time on a book, if more people can read it, that's very gratifying for an author.
Right.
And academic books, you know, you get an audience, but it's a smaller audience. And if you publish with a trade press, ideally you have a potentially larger audience, and that's very appealing. Mm-hmm.
Did you, I mean, you were, as you say in the acknowledgments, you were already out of your comfort zone in a sense with the time period and the topic, but how about the writing? I mean, is it easier to write a scholarly book, or is it, I mean, did it require something extra to be able to write a quote-unquote more popular?
Well, the earlier stages are the same.
Okay.
Whatever the audience is, you have to really dive into the sources, figure out what's going on and what you want to say about it. I think it is harder than writing for an academic audience because a lot of academic writers, like myself, you can take things for granted. And you can take your audience for granted because they're interested in a certain topic. You don't have to worry about them losing their interest. Whereas with the general audience, they could drop the book at any page. And I'm not saying that this is something you cannot stop reading, but it is something that you, when you write and trying to be both clear and engaging, it's an additional layer. So that's something that, you know, I think academic writers aim for that, but their audience tends to be more indulgent because they're fellow specialists. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think a general audience is not as indulgent. You know, they want something that's clear and speaks to them right away or else they're done.
Right. So your book is a fairly detailed look at various aspects of Meister Eckhart's life. His admission as a Dominican brother, his studies in Paris, increasing responsibilities as a leader in the order, his pastoral activities, his theological speculations. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover all of this. You know, folks will just have to read the book.
I hope so.
Yes. But I did want to ask about several things that I hope will give listeners a sense of, of what you've written. So first, you go into some of the influences, for example, the literary and religious influences that led young Eckhart of Hochheim to choose a mendicant life over other opportunities open to him. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about these influences and about how they lingered even into his later life.
Sure. So the first part of the book, my book's divided into four parts. In the first part, I talk about young Eckhart, so roughly up to his mid-30s. And the mid-30s are the first documentary evidence we have of these discussions he had with younger novices at his priory. The earlier part, I thought was very important, was to contextualize this all, because most treatments of Eckhart sort of start midstream when he's all grown up, and also gives short shrift to the development of his ideas over life. And I think, like everybody, he evolved over the course of his life. He wasn't static. So I wanted to start where his early formation. And the two things that seemed most important for me were, one, that he was a noble, and the kind of culture that entailed, including this idea of courtly love and pursuing what we know from the Arthurian legend as the Holy Grail, and that it's the one thing. I thought that was very important to get a sense of the noble outlook on the world. And then the second thing was his formation as a Dominican. And the Dominicans were a relatively new order in the 13th century. And their primary focus was on teaching, and on preaching and teaching. They were actually called the Order of Preachers, OP. And that was very important to him, is that it's important to learn things and to understand the Bible and other theological questions. But the true test is making that available to your fellow Christians, preaching it. And so that was impressed on him from an early age, because he entered the order probably 15 or 16. And so the idea of useful knowledge, not just knowledge for its own sake, but useful knowledge, combined with this sort of seeking of the noble quest, I thought both of those were very important, and they're very evident in his later sermons. And it's an example of reading against the grain and finding those things in his adult life, and then connecting them with the social context that he came from. Right. So that's the earliest part of the book. And you know, again, most treatments of Eckhart just gloss over that because
they don't know they don't have evidence.
Direct biographical sources. And as a historian, you know, I'm very concerned with context. You can't just have the text; you have to have the context. And so I think those two influences, the noble upbringing and the Dominican training, help you understand the adult Eckhart.
Right.
Yeah.
You also talk about, and this is kind of backing out a little bit from Eckhart, but getting at the social context, you talk about changes in economic value at the time and what kinds of influences they had on how people imagined their world. I mean, what economic, political, religious kinds of things were kind of coming into play that impinged upon Eckhart's formation of a perspective on life, as far as you can tell?
So starting around the year 1000, there was a gradual boom in cities and in commerce. So by the 13th century, by the time Eckhart was born, there's really the foundations of a money economy, and where money is a much bigger part of everyday life than it had been earlier. And this is something a lot of people complain about. And I think a lot of us today will see similarities and affinities when they talk about consumerism and selfishness and people monetizing everything and thinking of everything in monetary terms and being greedy and dishonest and things like this. I mean, you can find that in any period, but I think what's specific to the 13th century is it's focused on money. And so I think both the noble culture and the Dominican culture are in some ways reactions against that. The nobles reject the pursuit of money for honor, for finding the truth. And the Dominicans reject that for finding truth and spreading that truth to fellow Christians. So Eckhart is part of the reaction against the materialism of his day. And so again, as a historian, I thought that it was important to point out.
So there, as you say, the Dominicans were a relatively new order, and you talk about the Franciscans as well, who were a relatively new order at the time. Why, do you have a sense about why, or I mean, I know you do, a sense about why Eckhart picked the Dominicans over, say, the Franciscans? I mean, why, you know, there were choices.
Right.
Why?
Well, no, it's actually, it's a speculation on my part.
Right.
I mean, he's obviously somebody who's very intellectually gifted, and the Dominicans place a high emphasis on education and learning.
Mm-hmm.
It might have just been as simple, though, that he went to a Dominican school as a teenager, and they were the ones who got to him first. And that's what often happens with the religious orders, and that's why they're always trying to compete and get the best students at their schools because they're potential friars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know. I mean, I can speculate looking backwards that he clearly is an intellectual and he's drawn to things like that. But I think the fact that he went to the school and he was exposed to them and their ideals early on was also very important. But he lived near Franciscans and other Cistercians and other types of orders that he could have joined.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I think that's the most we can say about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly one that seemed to, for whatever reason, resonate with him. He really enjoyed both the knowledge and the preaching, which were essential to Dominicans.
Right.
Yeah.
So the knowledge part, one of the paths open to Meister Eckhart, once he had been in the order for a while, and I should say, I mean, you spend some time in the book talking about what it was like to be a Dominican. I mean, how you developed as a person in that context. But so I mean, that's fascinating, just sort of information about what it is to be that kind of person in that kind of situation. But one of his paths, one of the paths open to him was to spend time at various intervals studying and teaching in Paris. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that happened and what Paris was like for a Dominican coming to learn and to teach.
Sure.
Others.
Yeah, I think he had three overlapping vocations as a Dominican, and one was preaching, which all Dominicans did, and another was administrative leadership, which very few did, but the third was scholarship, and he spent, from young age on, he was trained at Paris, which was the premier university for theology, and in Cologne and in other places, and then he pursued his graduate degree in theology. And it's very daunting because those are the people who are the most famous theologians of the day. Some of them are very obviously haughty to young people coming in who think they can learn these such things. Studying theology was the hardest course at the university. It required 16 years,
wow,
including undergraduate. And yeah, it was a lot. And so there were very few people who attained the level of master, which is what we would call a doctor, you know, a PhD. And so they were the creme de la creme, the ones who actually made it, and then the ones who became well known for their writing. So it was a long path. It was one that was interspersed with assignments in the order of administration. It was not a steady study. It was something that was interrupted a lot. And he was in his early 40s when he finally became a master, and he taught there for two different stints as a regent professor, and that was also unusual. Most people visiting professors might have one, and he had two, so that tells you something about his status.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like the academic world today. It's an exciting world, but it's also got its own intrigues and its own jealousies and its mixture of looking for true knowledge and just sheer ambition. And so he had to figure out how to maneuver in this world and still be true to his Dominican calling. And it's not an easy thing.
Yeah, you even, I mean, from the, I guess, the more social historical perspective, I mean, you talk about, you know, just the amount of time it took for him to get from his town where he was living all the way into Paris, you know, various language.
And they walked. They walked the whole way.
And the linguistic issues that would come into play when you kind of move out of your territory, and then living, actually living there, and what?
It was a completely different world. I mean, it was, I don't know, he must have learned some French. I don't have any record of that. Obviously, at the university, everybody spoke Latin, and they could get around with that. In fact, they're not supposed to speak their native language. But, of course, the Germans tended to hang out with the Germans, and the French with the French, and the English with the English. But the common language was Latin, and he was fluent in that. But no,
thus the Latin Quarter. I mean,
exactly the Latin Quarter. That's what the university quarter was called, the Latin Quarter, still is. And you know how he interacted with French people in Paris, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I am going to actually ask you some questions about the administrative and the pastoral, but I wanted to ask. The kind of the huge question, I guess, which occupies a pretty big section of your book, which has to do with his theological speculations. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they developed over time, and some are more readily comprehensible to me than
for
others. and they include things like the divine spark, letting go-ness, mm-hmm. or Gelassenheit, the ground beyond God. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can't go into detail about any of these, but I wonder if you could speak briefly, maybe not so briefly, but about how Eckhart conceived of God, about the human relationship with the divine. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you've already talked a little bit about the mystic. So what about these ideas makes him the dangerous mystic?
Sure.
Of the book's title?
All right, well, that's a big question.
Yeah.
I would say one of the things I tried to get at was, again, the evolution of his thought over the course of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little tricky because we don't always have the secure dating of the documents. But there are some, the earlier ones, when he was in his 30s, we know that for sure. And I tried to talk about his thoughts at that point and then compare it to later on. The younger Eckhart is focused on a kind of letting go-ness. It's a German word he coins, Gelassenheit.
Mm.
Sometimes it's translated as detachment or other sorts of things, but it's really, it was a neologism, so I wanted to make it sound a little awkward.
Mm.
And also, letting go is also an act of faith. It's not just cutting yourself off from something, it's putting yourself in the hands of God or what's going to come. And he cultivates that very early on, but he's not really what we would call mystical. In a sense, he's not focused on mystical experiences. The closest he talks to a mystical experience in his younger days is the Eucharist.
Hmm.
You know, when the priest says the words to transform the essence of the bread and the wine into the body and blood of Christ. And for Catholics in general, that's a mystical moment because you're experiencing God directly. So he's very, very orthodox in that sense. What happens over the course of his life, including as a result of his studies of both theologians such as Thomas Aquinas, but also Neoplatonists, people who are reviving a certain type of Platonism, I would say two things, just to sort of oversimplify a little bit. And one thing is letting go of images of God.
Mm.
And this is called negative theology or apophatic theology. The other type would be using images to get to God and using words and descriptions. His is negative in the sense that anything you say or think about God is distortion. And it's better you get closer to God by saying what God is not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, God is not a person. God is not a man. God is not a being in the sense that we are beings. God is being. And so he tries to strip away all our preconceptions about this thing we call God. And that's very important for him because these preconceptions distort our behavior, he thinks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're looking for a God who's like a king who gives out favors. And that's not the kind of God Eckhart thinks we should be looking for. So I'd say the first part is that that kind of negative theology, which is well represented in the Dominicans.
Mm-hmm.
There are other people like Aquinas to a certain extent, even though he writes a long Summa Theologica on God, and, but he ultimately will agree that, you know, these are all approximations, and he would agree with Eckhart that, you know, all of our language, all of our metaphors, everything is just pointing toward God. It's not the same thing as God. It's like if I pointed to something with my finger, and instead of looking at the moon or whatever I'm pointing at, you look at my finger.
Mm.
And he says that's what happens, is we fixate on the language and the metaphors and the images, and we should be thinking about what do they point toward?
Mm.
What do they... And so that's the first part, you know, creating a space for a different type of God. And then the second part is the part that people think of as mystical. I would actually call it more intuitive.
Mm.
Is that there is a divine presence within each person already. So in other words, rather than looking in creation and looking outward, it's an inward journey, and it's actually an excavation. It's that, what he calls divine spark, he calls it other things, is buried by all these other things. It's what we would call the ego.
Mm.
You know, all these constructions of identity and wishes and desires and these sorts of things. And we also have to let go of those. So here's the letting go again. And it's when we learn to let go of all of these, you know, it's what a Jungian would call an inauthentic self,
mm.
you know, the fake self. When we let go of that, then within that, each of us, there's this divine spark. We comes to us. We're aware of it.
Mm.
So it's a moment of what he calls divine birth,
mm-hmm.
or what earlier Christians call the second birth, or it's the discovery of the authentic self in the divine within, as opposed to this worldly self that we've all constructed over the course of our lives. And you can see by the way I'm describing it how it would appeal to a lot of people in the modern era.
Right.
We talk about things in different ways, the same thing in different ways. So I think this intuitive experience of the divine is a key second part to his theology. And I would say there's a third part, and this is a part that sometimes gets neglected, that the natural result of this experience of the divine, and he uses all types of language. He says you can't use language to talk about it, but of course that's all we have. So he uses lots of images and languages, and I could talk more about that if you'd like, but the natural outcome of that is a life of love.
Mm.
So he's not talking about just experiencing God and then, you know, sitting on your mountaintop or sitting in your cloister. That once you experience the divine, you are filled with that love, because God is love, and you want to go out and help your fellow humans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, so that it's very traditional Christianity in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's based on both an experience of God, but more importantly, the love, charity, caritas. And he talks a lot about that. And the phrase that I think best sums up his attitude is living without a why.
Mm.
And in other words, you don't do these things because it'll get me to heaven,
mm-hmm.
because it'll make God happy, because of this, because the priest tells me to do it. You just do it because you want to, because it's what a loving person does. You know, we're used to thinking, and this is where I think the money economy comes in, we're used to thinking of God in very transactional terms.
Mm-hmm.
If I do this, God will do that.
Mm-hmm.
If I do my part, you know, if I accumulate a lot of merit and avoid sins, God will reward me. And Eckhart pushes back against that and says, you've got to do these things not for any reason. You just do it because it's the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you do it also, ideally, because you're filled with this sense of the divine that, I don't want to say compels you to do it, impels you to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an important part that I think sometimes some of the modern admirers, they talk about the contemplative part, but they leave out the active part.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody who was very active.
Mm-hmm.
He was out in the world
mm-hmm.
his entire life.
So, you can kind of see why he would potentially get in trouble for some of these ideas at the time. I mean, it's sort of the divine within. He's not saying you don't do anything, but he's he's talking about it in a slightly different way, that it's an outgrowth of this transformation that's happening. The acts that you do are this sort of a natural outgrowth.
Right.
Rather, I mean, it kind of upends some of the ideas.
Well, I think that's the danger both at that time and now, is that why do you need religion then?
Yeah.
If it's just this experience. And I think Eckhart would say traditional religion prepares you for that point of experience. It's a scaffolding.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some people who were deemed heretics during his time who were saying, you don't need religion. You can. They're called the brothers and sisters of the free spirit. You know, once you experience God, you can do whatever you want. And Eckhart comes out and says, no, that's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. First of all, you do need the church, or you need religion to help you get to that point. But secondly, if you're doing something that's against God, you're not really filled with the divine spirit. Mm-hmm. So he tries to separate himself. But, of course, some people who are enemies try to lump him together with them.
Mm-hmm.
And some modern Christians also are wary about Eckhart because they think he is anti-religious.
Mm.
I don't think he is, but I think he could be used that way. But I don't think he intended that in his own time.
Mm-hmm. And it's ironic that he would get this sort of anti-religious, we don't need the church sort of attitude, because besides his remarkable scholarly gifts, he had a lot of administrative ability, and he served in quite a number of leadership positions.
And he's a priest.
Yeah. It's like, so were there ways in which his theological views shaped his that you could tell his administrative practices, or vice versa? Is there anything in the sermons or in any
that's
other evidence?
Hard to say. I can't see, except maybe in the sense that it helped him translate his theology, which was, remember, he's reading all these Latin sources and debating in Latin, translated into the vernacular, where he creates a lot of new German words, and he creates images that are more accessible. So I think his experience in the world at large maybe helps with that.
Mm-hmm.
He is, from what I can tell, very anti-authoritarian.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's a very hierarchical world.
Mm-hmm.
And he is somebody who says anybody can do this. So he's reacting against that, saying it's not just some learned person or some monk or some nun. This is any Christian with a true heart can do this. As far as other influences of administration, I think love in action. You know, most of us don't necessarily think of administrative work as love. And I've certainly done a lot of administrative work in my life. It is service. I mean, ideally, you are helping other people in the best situations. You're helping other people. And so I think it's a kind of self-sacrifice and service. It's not something I think he sought out.
Mm.
But he was somebody who was very capable, so they sought him out.
Right. I mean, took him away from, you know, his scholarly activities.
Yeah, and I don't think he was happy about that, but who knows? I mean, I'm speculating. All you can say is he kept coming back to the scholarship whenever he had a chance.
Right.
And then the preaching in his later life. And that's his last 10 years. He just really, he has some minor administrative roles, but he really is focusing on his preaching and his teaching.
Right. So, I mean, you've talked a little bit about this, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more. How did the order shape his pastoral practices and theological speculations differently than, say, if he'd been a Franciscan? And then conversely, what was his impact was there some impact on the order that sort of lasted?
Well, in terms of theology, the Franciscans tend to develop a different theological tradition. So, for instance, they talk about positive theology, experiencing God through the good things of the world. If you think about St. Francis of Assisi, he's often portrayed as a nature saint, you know, who loves nature and animals. And that's within the Franciscan tradition, that once you experience love and beauty in the world, in the natural world, among humans, you climb a ladder that gets closer to God. So if you're familiar with the Divine Comedy, that's a Franciscan type of theology. Mm. You climb in wisdom and in love. The Dominicans and I would include Albert the Great and Thomas Aquinas and Dietrich of Freiburg, who was very important for Eckhart, and Eckhart, they talk about this negative theology more. Mm-hmm. And they're also more open to what Neoplatonism and ways of thinking about the divine that are somewhat different from the Franciscan tradition. So I would say Eckhart was part of his tradition. I'd say he also pushed it farther. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm leaving out some of the statements he made that really some of his contemporaries questioned. Mm-hmm. And he himself, he'd say these things and they said, but if you don't understand it, don't worry about it.
Right.
It's not that important. But he was you know, really pushing the threshold, pushing the frontier in new ways. And he talked about the divine in everything, which is one of the things that led to him being accused of pantheism.
Hmm.
But what it really is panentheism. And the difference is pantheism says God is all things. All things are God. Panentheism says there is divine in everything. Mm-hmm. There's a divine presence in everything. And there are lots of Orthodox Christians, including going back to St. Augustine, who would be in line with that. So I think the reason Eckhart got in trouble was he used a lot of hyperbole, and he said outrageous things.
Mm-hmm.
And he was using it in a way that, the Zen tradition uses a koan. It's mm-hmm. kind of, something that like a slap to wake you up. Like he'll say, God loves no one but himself.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, this sounds really different from what I heard. And what he means is, God loves the divine within each of us.
Mm.
And so he does love us, but he doesn't love the other parts. And he'll say a lot of things like this that are meant to get your attention. If you take them literally, it sounds dangerous. It sounds heterodox. But if you take it in the context, which he tried to explain, it's more orthodox and more traditional.
Right. And part of the problem was that as a Dominican, he was preaching.
Yeah.
And he was translating this stuff into
German.
Into his sermons into German.
Yeah.
And the lay people were listening.
And then they hear something like that and you think, what?
Right.
But you have to listen to the rest of it. And this was actually part of the accusations against him later in life, is that he said things that were misunderstood mm-hmm. by common people. And his response to that was basically, well, I can't help it if people misunderstand what I'm saying. I try to be as clear as I can, and I'm trying to follow the vocation to preach the gospel. And he quotes Augustine, who's St. Augustine is his big hero. But he does say things that at times were probably confusing to a lot of people, mm-hmm. but still are today.
Right.
I mean, I've read all his sermons, and a lot of people have read his sermons, and there are definitely parts where you're not quite sure what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's possible to be confused, certainly.
What were the circumstances that led to his being accused and the inquisitorial proceedings that
Well, so that happened later in life.
Yeah.
And he didn't really get in trouble for a lot of things he said. That's what some people might assume. It was a sort of local politics question. That is that there were two Dominicans who were accused of various misdeeds, consorting with women at night, rigging an election, taking money, and they're ready to be disciplined. And instead they say, we can hand you condemning statements by Meister Eckhart.
Hmm.
We can tell you things that he said that are dangerous and heretical. And from this, I would infer that there must have been some concern at some point among some people about Eckhart. Maybe not vocal, but just at the sense that he's pushing the frontier. And initially, Eckhart's investigated, and they find no basis for that, and the charges are dismissed, and these two friars are disciplined.
Mm.
But the one friar continues to make this argument against Eckhart. He really has it in for Eckhart. And the Archbishop of Cologne at the time is a very stern, law and order type of bishop, and any hint of heresy he wants to get at. And so when he hears about this, he jumps on it. And he gets the two people released, and he launches an inquisition. And part of the context for that is the Dominicans were not really that popular with the archbishop, because the Dominicans are not under the control of the archbishop. He only controls what are called secular clergy, the priests in the parishes. The Dominicans report to their own superior, so there's that problem, that they didn't, and he thought they were sometimes saying things that he didn't want them to say. The other was that the Dominicans supported these religious women called beguines. The beguines were women who lived together in communes, but who didn't take any vows, but they dressed like nuns. And so this was very confusing to some people, and the Dominicans used to give sermons and hear confessions from them, as did the Franciscans. And so the archbishop had some resentment already of the Dominicans. And so when you have this prominent Dominican who's denounced by two of his brothers, the archbishop pursues that. And I don't know if I want to give away what happened.
that's fine. Yeah.
But the case goes all the way, not to Rome, but to Avignon, because in the 14th century, the popes have moved, that's right, the Babylonian captivity, the popes have moved to Avignon in southern France, and so Eckhart pursues his case with the pope himself.
This is speculative, but how much trouble do you think he would have gotten into if this had all been in Latin? I mean, if he'd been doing his...
I think none at all.
Yeah.
I think the main thing that it was that it was misleading for common people.
Yeah.
And Eckhart, when he defended himself, he tried to defend the theology, and he got very sophisticated, and the interrogators didn't want to hear about that. They just want to say, did you say these things which could be misunderstood?
Right.
And he would try to say, well, what I meant by this was, and how this fits in our tradition, and they didn't care about that. All they cared was the exact words that he said.
Right. So your final chapter discusses the afterlife of Meister Eckhart's theological speculations, an afterlife that's stretched all the way to the present day. You talk about a person named Eckhart Tolle, who mixes some of Meister Eckhart's thinking with teachings from other religious traditions. We don't have time to kind of go into all the details, but what are some of the ways in which Meister Eckhart has been appropriated, and does anybody get him sort of more right? in quotes, I'm not exactly.
Yeah. Well, he's been appropriate a lot. I mean, after his death, his two most famous disciples are Heinrich Suso and Johannes Tauler, and they're actually better known in the later Middle Ages and the Reformation than Eckhart. And they are more conventional in their language, and they take a lot of what Eckhart says but make it more compatible with traditional theology. Eckhart himself is pretty much forgotten up until the 19th century, and it's the German Romantics who rediscover him. And of course, they love this emphasis on experience and on the soul and the mystical approach, and so his works are republished, are collected and published, several sermons, and there's a debate among Protestants and Catholics. Is he more Protestant? Is he more Catholic? You know, is he a Protestant before the Reformation?
Yeah, you have some serious problems with that.
Yeah, and so this is a time of, you know, strong Protestant-Catholic animus. I think one of the weirdest appropriations is by the Nazis in the 1930s, and it's mainly because of Alfred Rosenberg, who's the main propagandist of the Nazis, and he writes this awful book, but it's sort of the handbook of the National Socialist. And he claims Eckhart because he thinks Eckhart is pure German, pure Aryan, and he's anti-church. So in other words, the Nazis are opposed to the Catholic Church, and they think Eckhart was one of the earliest German heroes fighting against the tyranny of the Catholic Church, which is a serious twisting of it. And I don't think Rosenberg actually ever read Eckhart. And after the Nazis go away, Eckhart has a strong enough reputation that it's not harmed by that. Today there are a lot of different people who use him within religious traditions, without. Somebody like Eckhart Tolle is the spiritual but not religious people. I think he appeals to a lot of different people in different ways. He's very accessible. It emphasizes personal experience. It seems to be anti-hierarchical and anti-doctrinaire, which is something that's appealing to a lot of people today. As far as whether people get him right.
But besides, of course, your own
except book. For my book, right. No, it's hard because it's anachronistic. I mean, he's a 14th century person.
Mm.
And when we bring him into the 21st century, I don't know which of these movements he would align himself with. And there's to be honest, they would be so alien to him coming from the 14th century. I don't know that it would make sense. I mean, I definitely think he thought of himself within a Catholic tradition. So he might be closest to those Catholics who are also very ecumenical in using other religious and spiritual sources, as Eckhart did. He used a lot of Jewish and Muslim sources.
Mm.
I think he's very much in that sort of mode. He's not anti-biblical. I mean, he knows the Bible better than most conservative evangelicals. I mean, he's very versed in Scripture, but his interpretations might differ from some of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the people like Eckhart Tolle, my only beef would be if they leave out that last part of activism. In other words, it's not just about self-realization. It's about living an active life of love.
Mm-hmm.
That's the goal. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the means. The experience of God is not the end. It's the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if people leave that out, that really distorts Eckhart, and that would bother him. But, you know, one of Eckhart's favorite sayings was find the method that works the best for you.
Mm.
He was not a prescriptive type of preacher. He said God can come to people in different ways. It's very subjective. If one way works better than the other, then use that. I don't think he never comes out and says this is the only formula you can use. This is the only way to do it. So I think it would be hard to place him, but I think he thinks of himself as a Catholic, but an ecumenical Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So are you, the last question, are you planning to stay in the 13th and 14th centuries?
I'm running back to the 16th century. My new book, my current book that I'm working on is about a man named Hans Staden, who was a mercenary in the 16th century from Hesse. And he traveled to Brazil, what is now Brazil, and was kidnapped by the Tupinambá, who are cannibals.
Mm.
And he lived with them, for 9 months, and then he escaped and went back to Germany and wrote about his account. So something very different from Eckhart.
Okay, well, I look forward to talking with you about that at some point in the future.
Thanks.
Again, thanks for this conversation, Joel.
Thank you, Chris.
Again, I've been talking with Joel Harrington, Centennial Professor of History and Professor of German Studies, about his recent book, Dangerous Mystic, Meister Eckhart's Path to the God Within, published by Penguin Press. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.